Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed show today. Towards the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Frederick Kaufman, who's an associate editor for Harper's Magazine, and a journalist and an author. And we'll be talking with him about how Wall Street, particularly Goldman Sachs, but Wall Street in general and the system behind it, starves millions of people all the time and gets away with it. That's right, gets away with it, starving millions of people. And before that, we'll be talking with Peter Gleick, and we'll be talking with Peter about the bottled water craze and what's up with that and how it's just helping to destroy the planet. That's right, everybody drinking bottled water. Think again, not good. So that's the second segment of the show. And opening this show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show today Margaret Kimberly. Margaret is actually from blackagendareport.com. She does a lot of writing there, a lot of work on their site, a lot of commentary, and she has a blog called Freedom Rider. And I recently came across an entry in her blog called The Media's True Lies. I read it, and I really wanted to have Margaret on the show. So here she is, Margaret Kimberly. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, I'm going to jump right into this because there's just so much to talk about in here. You recently wrote this article about the media's true lies. Why don't you tell people what you're talking about there?
Well, I was referring specifically to Iran. There was a recent Gallup poll which showed most people, when asked which countries posed the most danger to the United States, a majority said, well, I don't know if a majority, but Iran was the number one country listed. And that is a direct result of the lies that the media is telling about Iran and about its non-existent nuclear weapons program. You wouldn't know that it was non-existent if you just watched the news and read the newspapers, but Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. I would argue that if it did, it would still be okay. But the media followed the line of the White House, whether it's the Obama administration or the Bush administration. They behave like little scribes. Instead of being reporters, instead of being journalists, instead of giving us facts, they tell us what people in power want us to be told. And the result of that is a country that hasn't, unlike the United States, hasn't invaded any other country, hasn't used weapons of mass destruction, which was, in fact, a victim of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons when Saddam Hussein was an ally of the United States in the Reagan administration. He used chemical weapons against Iranian soldiers. But none of this is ever revealed, even in the supposedly best papers in the New York Times, the paper of record, and the major networks, broadcast and cable networks. One would think that Iran was, in fact, a danger and that it had to be attacked in order for us to be protected and in order for Israel to be protected. But these lies go on about other things as well.
And you make a point in your piece that actually the level of danger posed by Iran is nowhere near the degree that the propaganda says it is. It's really very heavy because it is true. There's a constant thing. I mean, everything from the idea that, James Clapper that said, it seems like I think that the Iranians are actually capable of or thinking of, or they're probably able to launch a terrorist attack inside the U.S. And there was absolutely no proof, no evidence, no nothing. He just sort of off the top of his head, he's asserting this, and suddenly the press picks it up and runs with it.
Sure. Well, there's that. There's this the big lie. There is dirty work by, and I'm convinced it's on the part of Israel, the nuclear scientists, those that are working on Iran's nuclear energy program, being murdered since 2007. Four or five scientists have been killed, and they've been all killed in the same way, a magnetic bomb attached to their cars, and they've been blown up. Now, at about the time I wrote this piece, there was suddenly, so coincidentally, attacks on Israeli diplomats in India, and the Republic of Georgia and Thailand through the same mechanism, a bomb attached to a car. I believe that these attacks were staged. Nobody was killed, mind you. I think it was meant to give the impression that Iran was responsible. Now, it makes no sense for with the United States and Israel beating this drum for a war against Iran, for Iran to suddenly decide to strike against Israeli diplomats. My response was, what do you take me for? Do you really think I'm stupid? But many people, if they're not stupid, they're just uninformed. And, I used to think my whole life growing up, my parents always read the paper and watched the news, and I did as well. And I now realize you can do that every day, and still not know what's happening in the world.
What?
And that is the great tragedy of all.
Exactly. And that's something, I mean, look, I know myself too. I mean, I started reading the New York Times when I think I was in sixth grade or sometimes.
Right.
And, you know, and yes. So you read it and you had all the stuff that you were thinking about and you'd come away thinking, and for a lot of my life, I was reading two or three papers a day. And it really is true. It's not just that you don't know anything. You actually know a lot of wrong things.
Right. Well, you've been lied to. And the things that you think are true are not. And the things that you should know are ignored or twisted or dismissed in some way. So you end up, despite your best efforts, still being ignorant and being in support of things that are wrong for us as human beings, wrong for this country, wrong for other countries, and we end up advocating things that are quite terrible, like the coming war against Iran. You know, the only issue is, will Israel attack first or Iran attack or the United States attack first? And Netanyahu is here, and he and Obama do this good cop, bad cop thing, but I don't doubt for a moment that Obama is ready to do it.
Well, you look at what Obama's been saying. I mean, here he is standing up there, and he makes the point that not only does he say that, look, I want to make it clear that force is definitely an option that the U.S. will use. Then he adds, and nothing is off the table. No option is off the table, which very clearly is actually a modified use of nuclear weapons since they're using that as a threat against Iran.
Yeah, but then if the Republicans criticize him, he said they're beating the drums for war as if he is not. And that's meant to, I mean, people who love Obama, I don't know what he has to do to get them to stop loving him anyway. So they can, he's playing to his audience and they can say, well, Obama didn't want to do this. So, you know, he's the good cop and Netanyahu's the bad cop and the Republicans are the worst cop. But the end result will be, I think, fairly shortly, an attack on Iran carried out by the United States and or Israel.
Before we get into that, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Margaret Kimberly. She's from Black Agenda Report, and her blog is Freedom Writer. And we're talking about the lies that the media feeds us day in and day out, disinformation that's put out there. Partly it's put out there to keep you stupid and baffled and mindwashed. And another part of it is to create public opinion to carry out these heinous crimes that the U.S. is committing all over the world. Now, Margaret, one of the things that when you were talking about this, about what you see as the real possibility of war, you know, it is very interesting. And I think this is incredibly important because the only thing that actually is going to stand in the way of war is a conscious people standing up
right.
And saying, you know, and they need to oppose it. They can't stop it, they need to oppose it and really move to stand against what the U.S. will do there. And this idea that the lies that were being fed in the press daily and every kind of press, the newspapers, the radios, the television,
mm-hmm.
the culture, the movies. I mean, really, this idea of building up for war is a major thing that's going on. And you look at it, there's an irony there because the only country, as you alluded to earlier, the only country that's ever used nuclear weapons is the U.S. And the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons is Israel. And they talk about using them.
Oh, yes. But at the same time, if you read the papers, you would not know that Israel is a nuclear power no one's sure how many nukes they have. You would not know that Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But Israel has on its own developed this huge nuclear weapons program. And if you ask the average person who considers himself or herself well-informed, if you told them that, most people, I think, would look at you like you were making something up. And, you know, you get to be dismissed and treated like a crazy person just because you say things that other people are unaware of. And they're unaware because the information has been kept from them.
And part of it, it's like you were saying about Obama. I mean, there's a particular pass that Obama is given, which is tied up with, I think, the role that they intended him to play, that the powers that be intended him to play when he got elected,
mm-hmm.
you know. And let's look at the reality of what this guy is doing. He was very well vetted for the job he got. He's not one of these cats that's going to get in there and start yelling, okay, gotcha, fooled you. Now I'm really going to, I'm letting loose with some
well,
good stuff.
Nobody gets in there and does that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
That's
exactly.
That's the argument black people make for every bad choice we're presented with. I know it's about, believe it or not, it's almost 20 years ago now since Clarence Thomas became a Supreme Court justice and many black people defended him by saying, well, wait till he gets in there. He's going to be, well, he's, you know, obviously precisely who he was before. And Barack Obama, you know, nobody gets to be president who isn't vetted. The first step to being president is to get rich people to fall in love with you. And for years before 2008, he went around the country making the right, that is to say, rich friends, and making the case for himself as a candidate who would be agreeable to them, that is to say, who wouldn't do anything to hurt them. And if you don't do that, you don't get to be president. You know, we're not going to have any transformative presidents. It's just not going to be allowed in the system we have. The only way to get policies that are beneficial to the great masses of people is for us to demand them. I mean, that's always been the case. People who like Obama, I've given up trying to tell them not to like him, but I wish they could see that the answer to the problems of all Americans is for us to be involved and to make demands.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report and the blog Freedom Rider, and we're talking about the lies of the media, Barack Obama, and the drive towards war against Iran. Well, you know, even there, though, I'd have to say, too, that we have to think, I think we have to go a little deeper. You know, so I think this idea, people really have to begin to come to grips with what really is going on in the society. And I think what I was going to try and get to, though, around Obama is there's a point that Andrew Sullivan made before Obama was even considering running, and or he might have just been announcing that he was considering running. And Sullivan wrote an article where he talked about the best person. He said the best person to be president, that if this system really wanted to make its gains, what it has to do in the world today is to have Barack Obama become president because of the impact that it would have on the international situation. The idea that people, you know, he specifically said this little kid sitting in Pakistan, you know, with drones flying all around him and bombing the village, but yet he's looking on the television and he sees that there's a black man named Barack who's running the country. You know, there's a certain amount of public opinion making with the idea of bringing together a base for this, because it really does have that effect, I think. This is why we can look at the fact that the anti-war movement is nowhere near commensurate with what has been going on. And the response to these threats on Iran is nowhere near what's needed. And a lot of that has to do still, I think, with the remaining pull that Obama has on numbers of people hoping that perhaps he won't go that far.
Yeah, I don't know what he has to do for people to have that hope. I mean, I'm thinking about what you said about Andrew Sullivan. Was his point that if we have a black man as president, he can get away with the same evil, and the kid in Pakistan won't mind being bombed by somebody with the name Obama? I'm not sure what that point was, but at any rate, Andrew Sullivan is a man who liked George Bush, lest we forget, and then stuck his finger in the air and saw the winds changing and came over to the Democratic side. But
actually, what I was asking you, it has to do in terms of, you know, really what the role of the media in these lies that they're telling, the role that it has in cementing a social base for the kinds of things that they're going on, you know, which is, it's more than just keeping people dazed and confused. There's actually a thing about cementing a social base, and in particular with Obama, bringing together these people who, you know, a lot of the liberals who actually said, look, they'll say now, the big response you get is, yeah, but he's better than Santorum or Gingrich or, you know.
Yeah, no, damning with faint praise. But, you know, my argument now is, all right, suppose one of them became president instead of Obama. What would be different? It seems to me that the things that would be different would be a matter of style. It would be different. It would be, you know, social issues that are important, and I don't mean to dismiss them. A Republican would not end, don't ask, don't tell. So there are things that Republicans would do that I would not like, but the larger picture of how the system works wouldn't change. We still have this the economic elite using these tactics to get us to take one side or another when there's a constant. The constant is the 1% gets more and more and more. And that doesn't change whether you have a Democrat or a Republican. The United States being the biggest warmonger on earth does not change. The United States military budget is bigger than the military budgets of the rest of the world combined. That does not change whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in office. When challenged, we don't even have a Democrat who will stand up and say, I'm not going to cut Medicare or Social Security. And now we have those cuts. So really, the differences get fewer and fewer and fewer. And I, at this point, am less afraid of having a Republican in office than I used to be, because I used to be of that frame of mind. Any Democrat's better than any Republican. But I think thinking that way leads us to accept all sorts of terrible things from Democrats. I mean, I don't know what Obama has to do before people are willing to question him, that the president can make the case that he can kill anybody. He can decide that somebody is a terrorist and kill them, even an American citizen like Al-Laki, and then kill his teenage son, a 15 or 16-year-old kid, that the president can destroy the nation of Libya the United States and NATO can get together and say, oh, you know, we want that oil. We could just do without Gaddafi. And the next thing you know, Gaddafi's dead and Libya has been turned over to actually to Al-Qaeda. And, you know, we go on and on about worrying about Islamic fundamentalists, but that's what's running Libya now. And back people who have carried out a race war within Libya, African migrant workers and Libyans who are darker skinned have been systematically, well, they've been targeted for death. They've been killed. They're in prison. They're being tortured. And all because of the first black president of the United States. So I'm less and less afraid of having Republicans in power. And I think, frankly, a lot of the opposition to them amounts to pretty much some snobbery, you know, that they're the dumb ones and they're opposed to abortion. And I don't take that issue lightly. I'm pro-choice. And I'm glad that Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended. But it's not enough to make me forget that Obama is sending drones to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they're killing little children, to forget what's happened to Libya, to not to notice that there's about to be an attack on Iran.
Exactly.
So I think that argument doesn't cut any ice with me.
Exactly. And I completely agree. I mean, look, I think the idea of one or the other, either one is going to serve the interests of empire. And quite frankly, right now, the Democrats are able to do that better than the Republicans. And if the Republicans were in there, they would do it in their own way, as we've seen time and time again. When you go from Tweedledee to Tweedledum, in and out and in and out, it doesn't really matter who's doing it. It's who's best serving the interests of the empire. And to me, you know, that's the key point. That's what the press is all about. And these lies that they constantly tell, that's what that's all aimed at gearing up and shoring up. All right, Margaret, thank you very much for joining us today. And your blog is Freedom Writer?
Yes, I have a blog, freedomwriter.blogspot.com, and also blackagendareport.com. We have a new edition every Wednesday, so check out blackagendareport.com.
Definitely will. Thank you very much for joining us, Margaret.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, take care now. All right, we've been talking with Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report and the blog Freedom Writer, and we've been talking about the big lies of the media that are swamping the newspaper and the press and the culture today to justify and build up support for a war against Iran. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Peter Gleick about bottled water, good thing or curse on the planet. Stay tuned if you really want to find out. Welcome back. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was Water Drum 1 by the Baca Forest People. I thought it was an extremely appropriate piece for our next guest. Peter H. Gleick is the president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Award, and he's the author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. And he's a fervent, ardent drinker of tap water. Okay, so wrap your head around that one. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me
sure.
on.
Sure. I got to tell you, I was reading your book. I was horrified, surprised, and extremely pleased to read some of the things that you were revealing in this book. This is really a book well worth reading for anybody who's concerned about the state of humanity and the state of the planet, but also just the hucksterism and what's really getting a scientific view of all of these things that were so often presented as you're walking through society and you have and your head's spinning because you have no idea what the hell's going on. You know, tap water, bottled water, what do I do here? But let me begin with this, a quote from the beginning of your book. You say, every second of every day in the United States, 1,000 people buy and open up a plastic bottle of commercially produced water. And every second of every day in the United States, 1,000 plastic bottles are thrown away. 85 million bottles a day. More than 30 billion bottles a year at a cost to consumers of tens of billions of dollars. And for every bottle consumed in the U.S., another 4 are consumed around the world. Peter, what the hell is going on here?
Well, that's a great question. It's a big story, this bottled water thing. It sort of has come out of nowhere over the last decade or so. As sort of unbeknownst to us, sales have grown and grown and grown until all of a sudden bottled water's everywhere. I think it's time that we ask what's really going on. And as I talk about in the book, I think there are 4 things going on. I think we're increasingly afraid of our tap water. We have a wonderful tap water system in the United States, although, as I point out in the book, it's not as good as it could be and not as good as it should be. But it's a great system that most of the rest of the world wishes they had. So we're afraid of our tap. I think we're deluged and bombarded with misleading advertising about bottled water, about how it's going to make us healthier or sexier or skinnier or more stylish if we drink this or that brand of bottled water. And I think it's harder and harder to find public water. The water fountains are disappearing at the same time that bottled water is everywhere. You can buy it. Most of us could probably think right now a place to buy bottled water that's a couple of blocks from where we're sitting or even closer.
Yeah, I could walk out the door here and just reach the refrigerator and find a zillion bottles of bottled water. I mean, think about it. For people my age, your age, and I was asking people in the station this morning, when we were kids, when we were younger, bottled water was really a rarity. I mean, we used to drink out of a hose.
It was unheard of. I grew up in New York City originally, a city that has a wonderful public water supply. If my mother had ever come home with bottled water from the store, it would have been a stunning event. It was just unheard of. We all drank from the fountains, from the taps, from water, from hot fire hydrants in the street. That's just the way it was, and I think that's the way it still should be.
Well, you know, when you were talking about the causes of all this or how this happened, one of the things I think, it's not just that we fear the tap, because I think actually from my perspective, there's actually a healthy suspicion of what's going on, what the government is doing to people, and things that we find out many years later that, oh, yeah, we meant to tell you about that mosquito truck you used to run behind, DDT, right? And it'll kill you. So there's all these things that come out, and we actually, there's fear of the tap, there's suspicion of the government, but there was actually a war on tap water that was orchestrated by the bottled water czars.
Well, that's right. I think their biggest competitor is the tap. If they can make us fear the tap, which isn't that hard, they can convince us to buy a bottled water, their commercial private product, at 1,000 times or more what we pay for our tap water. Now, you know, I argue that our tap water should be better, but I also think there's a lot of fear of the tap that's unwarranted. I think the tap water we get is, for the most part in this country, remarkably safe. Incredibly safe. I think it could be safer. I think there are things that are in it that aren't well regulated or that we don't fully understand sometimes the consequences of some of the things that are in our tap water. But we know how to produce tap water of any quality. We could produce the best quality tap water with technology that we have at a cost far below what we spend for bottled water. And so fix the tap system, ensure that people trust it, make it so that people can trust it again. And that will help drive the sales of bottled water, which has all sorts of problems associated with it, back down to what it ought to be, which is a occasional luxury product.
Well, you also make the point, and we'll talk about this. We can talk about it now, or we can talk about it a little bit later, is that while you're exposing all this, that bottled water in and of itself is actually not the root cause of the problem we're facing in relation to water. I mean, I've lived many parts of the third world, and frankly, bottled water is absolutely essential and unfortunately has been one of the ways that I think one of the things that has cut down on things like cholera and these other waterborne diseases that kill quite a few people. And it's not enough, obviously, and there's actually more needs to be done to get access to healthy, clean water, water that would be the equivalent of the tap system in this country. I was in KwaZulu in South Africa, and I once made the mistake, temporary insanity, I was really thirsty, and I was in this little sort of rondeval that was, had a sink in there, it had a tap. And for whatever reason, I walked over, got a big glass, the water was cold, poured it down, and my friends who were from KwaZulu looked at me and said, "Whoa, we don't even do that." And boy, I was sick for a long time. But
well,
go ahead.
You know, without a doubt, there are parts of the world where you can't drink the tap water. And that certainly has spurred the bottled water industry overseas. But again, the answer is that's unfair. That's inequitable. That's not the world we want to live in. We want a world where governments build and maintain and operate a high quality, inexpensive tap water system for everyone. If we don't do that, what happens is the rich buy bottled water and the sick continue to drink contaminated water and they get sick and they die. The poor get sick and they die. And that's not the world we want. And that's the world we got rid of in the United States 100 years ago when we built a high-quality tap water system. We got rid of cholera and dysentery and typhoid, those same water-related diseases, when we started filtering and chlorinating our tap water. I think the bottled water industry is a symptom of a big problem. I think you're exactly right. It's not a problem. Well, it is a problem by itself, which we can get into. But it's because of these other reasons that we feel compelled to believe that bottled water must be better. Now, I'd also point out there's no guarantee that the quality of bottled water is any better than our tap water. It's not as well regulated as our tap water. And so sometimes people buy bottled water because they think it's better than tap water, but I think often we're fooling ourselves.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You know, when I first came out here, I was shocked at how much bottled water was a part of people's lives. I was living on the East Coast, and at that point, bottled water wasn't just that big a part of my life. But when I came out here, I mean, people I was staying with were insistent they were going, and it always used to freak me out because they would go to Vons and they would buy, you know, they would see a machine selling water, and it was just a water dispenser, you know, and they would put their dollar in or their quarter, whatever, and get gallon after gallon of water that later was exposed as a total sham. It was just tap water that had been put in the machine. But people really believed that they were drinking safer water. What's the truth here?
Well, our tap water is regulated by the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Bottled water is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration as a food product because it's in this little packaged container. And that's why, in fact, that incredibly uninformative nutrition label is what's on it, which tells us really nothing. The regulations are supposed to be similar and, for the most part, are fairly similar. But bottled water is not as strictly regulated in many cases, I believe, as tap water. The monitoring of bottled water is done by the companies themselves, not by independent agencies. The reporting isn't as good as for tap water, and there's some big loopholes. I think for the most part, bottled water is perfectly safe. I think for the most part, tap water is perfectly safe. But consumers should not assume that bottled water is any better or any safer or any better regulated than tap water. I think that's a false assumption.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking right now with Peter Gleick, the author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. Now, Peter, one of the things that shocked me in the book to see, I mean, you talked about the lax regulation, lax to zero regulation, or even if the rules are written, they're rarely enforced. And what that leaves the door open to, I mean, you know, E. coli, a lot of us are used to, you know, oh God, E. coli, it's in the hamburger or it's in the, you're on your lettuce leaves or your spinach or whatever. So you're, you know, scrubbing your spinach with an iron brush. But actually, there's instances, or it's possible that E. coli and other coliform bacteria is actually in the bottled water because they don't check for it, right?
Well, they do. They're supposed to check for it. But the rules, again, especially for things like that kind of bacteria, like E. coli, are stricter for tap water. They have to monitor daily, often dozens of times a day in a big city, for bacteria like that, for E. coli. And if they find any, they have to notify the public right away. And they have to issue alerts so that people don't drink it. Now, it's very rare in tap water. But for bottled water, they have to look every now and then, not as often, for the most part, as big cities do. And, in fact, they're allowed to have some bacteria, small amounts of bacteria in bottled water, without it being considered contaminated. When we do look carefully at bottled water quality, we find problems. And in my book, I chronicle a whole series of examples of bottled water contaminations that the public was never notified about. I had to file a Freedom of Information Act request with the Food and Drug Administration to get this information, and it found examples of bacteria and glass particles and sanitizer and mold and all sorts of things occasionally found in bottled water that the public was either not notified about or was notified long after the bottles were sold.
Let's talk about, you mentioned in your book that the problem here is not just economic problems being caused, but there's environmental, but there's other bigger problems too. Let's talk a little bit about the social cost of bottled water.
Well, part of the social cost is this, to me, concern that we're just going to stop supporting our tap water system. That's a system that provides everyone with safe and affordable clean water. If we abandon our tap water system, if we let it go to hell in a handbasket, then the rich will buy bottled water and the poor will drink contaminated water, and so that's a social problem. But there are a whole set of other issues associated with the energy required to make and move bottled water, which is enormous, the environmental implications of disposing of these plastic bottles, and 70% of them never get recycled. They end up in our landfills, they end up by the side of the road, they end up in trash. They could be recycled, but they're not. Those are problems associated with bottled water, too, that I think as a society we don't adequately understand or deal with.
Well, this is one thing. This is one aspect of your book that I really feel obliged to hit on, and that's the hucksterism, because it just, you know, I go through life just enraged all the time, every time I see this. And in fact, although I took notes down saying, now, you're sure that drinking bottled water will not make me slimmer. Is that you're going to stand behind that?
Oh, well, let me qualify that. There are a bunch of bottled waters that are advertised as weight loss waters, and I think that's the FDA really ought to get on that, because that's completely crap. But if you do drink several glasses of water before you eat, you may well eat less, and that may be an interesting weight loss program, but it has nothing to do with the special properties of bottled water. You could get that same benefit from drinking any water. So I think that's a bogus claim.
So what about hexagonal water?
Well, there are all sorts of other bizarre claims about bottled water, about having specially reorganized and rearranged the molecules, about there's some pretty clearly medicine show snake oil type of waters out there that I think the Food and Drug Administration or the Federal Trade Commission, whoever's responsible for protecting us from misleading advertising, ought to be dealing with. I think they've fallen down on the job on this, and the public is often being misled about these special bottled waters.
For a long time, I believed that there were a bunch of elves in the North Pole who were rearranging water molecules, and then I found out that was Santa Claus and Christmas, and that's true, but the elves in the North Pole making water was not true. Okay,
yeah, that's
it. Back on the social cost of water, because I do think this is really important. You know, you had made a point earlier about it was with the development of the tap system, and to the extent that it's developed, and a very highly developed one, that we were able to wipe out things like cholera, in conjunction with other programs, and we're able to wipe out things like cholera and dysentery and all this. But then social impact of the neglect of the tap, and that image you painted of that possible world. I mean, you talk about it in your book, you talk about a couple of possible futures, and frankly, one that you paint, which is coming off of what you were just talking about, the social cost of bottled water. You've conjured up a world that is bone-chillingly similar to what we all shivered at when we first saw it in the film Blade Runner. You know, and it reminds me even a lot, there's a lot of similarities between this and the fossil fuel industry, you know, and the whole way that they're rampaging through society. Can you talk to that a little bit and then maybe talk about what your vision of the future is?
Well, I think bottled water, as I said earlier, is a symptom of a much bigger set of problems with water. Water is our most precious resource. We don't treat it and use it sustainably in the United States or in California or in the globe, throughout the world as a whole. I think we can move to a sustainable future for water. I think we could provide safe and clean water and sanitation for everyone. We haven't done it, but we could do it. It's not a technological problem. It's not a money problem. It's a problem of commitment and will. I think we could move to a world in which our natural ecosystems share in the water that we use. Many of our environmental problems, certainly in California and the western U.S., but elsewhere as well, are associated with the fact that for years, for decades, we've taken more and more water out of the environment for human use. You know, we move water from the Sierra Nevada to the coasts and Northern California to Southern California, or, you know, the Colorado River is completely consumed. And that's brought enormous advantages to us, but it's also caused a lot of big environmental problems. It's time to treat the environment as a user as well. They deserve a sustainable share of our water resources. I think we can move to that future. I think we can move to a future where we understand how climate change is going to affect us and we manage the unavoidable consequences of climate change. I think there's good news out there in the water world, but as long as we continue to think that bottled water is an acceptable alternative to a safe tap water system, as long as we continue to assume that humans can take all the water they want without protecting the environment, I think the possibility of a bad future is certainly out there.
I want to sort of begin to wrap this thing up here, but I want to make the point that the vision that you laid out just now, the fact, the idea, the thinking that there's nothing actually holding this back, really, except, and I think it's the social relations and the production relations that exist in society. There's no technological reason. There's certainly not a question of need. There's not like we couldn't do this if we didn't really grasp it or something. There's something blocking this. And you make a point at a number of points in your book. You make the basic point that this is bigger than environmental, bigger than economic, that it's a basic question of human rights and the right of all humans to have access to good, clean water. And it's also a question of the survival of the planet. And so in that question, the bigger question of the whole future of humanity. And your vision, when I read that in your book, I was really inspired by that. But I was also forced to say, you know, I don't think under this system. Do you really think that there's some way that you can achieve this, given where we exist now in this society?
You know, I do. Maybe it makes me a rosy-eyed optimist. I do believe that we can have a sustainable water system around the world. I do believe that it's achievable. I believe it's inevitable. It's not a technological problem. It's not an economic problem. It's a question of political will. It's a question of activism on the part of people understanding where their water comes from and pushing agencies and communities and governments to do the right thing. I'm not naive. I do believe it's going to be difficult. The question is, how much pain and suffering are we going to have to go through before we move to a sustainable system of water management and water planning and water use? But I absolutely believe it's achievable. I think we just have to understand more about our water. We have to take responsibility for our own decisions about water, and we have to move policymakers and politicians in the right direction, not the wrong direction.
Well, I would say I really like your vision, and I would agree with you that we can do this, but I think there's a big impediment, and that is the fact that in order to do this, we have to get rid of a society that functions first and foremost on profit before everything, because that actually ends up with a whole big mess, ends up where we are now. And that's something you and I can continue to wrestle with, but I really want to follow your work on this, and I want to thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure, Peter. Take care, and we'll talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Peter Gleick, author of Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. Check it out. It's a really great book. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Fred Kaufman, an associate editor at Harper's and an author, and we'll be talking about how Wall Street systematically starves millions all the time and gets away with it. So you don't want to miss this. Stay tuned.
Pick up on this! Pick up on this! Ha. Hey! I'm a greedy man. Greedy man. I'm a greedy man. I'm a greedy man. Hey! I'm a greedy man. Now, brother, don't leave the home with undone.
All right, that was James Brown with I'm a Greedy Man. Very appropriate for this segment of the show because we're going to be talking about all things Wall Street, and that means all things greed. You know, just a little while ago, I was paging through some old issues of Harper's Magazine, and I found an article that really intrigued me. The name of that article was The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. And I looked at the article, and I found the author of the article. His name is Fred Kaufman, and he's joining us here today on the show. Fred, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, Michael?
I'm very good, man. Although I have to tell you, I've read your article about three times, and boy, you know, one of the things that it really pointed out to me is that, you know, I've always been very, very angry about the idea that even the most basic needs people face, nothing can be done to even speak to that without them being turned into some sort of profit motive. And when I saw your article, and the title of it in particular, The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It, I just immediately had to sit down and read it, and it just really, really tore open a lot of stuff for me in terms of shining a light, but also, what the hell is going on, man?
Well, listen, thank you, Michael, and this is really scary stuff. I mean, there is a kind of a little apocalyptic free zone you get from this, you know, because when you think about what the banks are doing, I think everybody is on to the fact that these guys are ripping us off and that these guys are then, you know, depending on taxpayer money to bail them out. And I think on a certain level there's a lot of anger out there against the large Wall Street banks. But this was, even for me, beyond the pale when I started working on this story about a year ago. I just could not believe what I was uncovering, that in fact the Wall Street banks were not just stealing money, they were starving people. And in 2008, let me just say one thing. People are so inured to hungry people. People are just used to the fact that, oh, yeah, there are lots of hungry people out there. Let me put this in very basic terms. In 2008, food prices rose to such an amazing extent that a quarter of a billion new people became hungry in that one year. That's an astounding fact. It's the worst statistic in the history of humanity, is 250 million people joining the ranks of the hungry in one year. And this had to do with the price of food, and we can talk about that if you like.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I want to know how that happened. You make a point there that you start off by saying in 1991, the history of food took an ominous turn. And that actually was the first step on this whole path. Can you, let's get into this.
Yeah, I think even before this, I think everybody has to understand that there is enough food in the world to feed everybody. There, it's not a population problem. It's not a production problem. It's not a distribution problem. In fact, there is double the amount of food in the world today to feed everybody. Okay, so let's just get that out of the way. Therefore, what is stopping most people from eating? What's stopping most people from eating is that a third of the world is living their lives on less than $2 a day. Okay, that's really what's stopping the world from eating. Now, maybe you or maybe some of the listeners remember that in 2008, a quart of milk got more expensive. A dozen eggs got more expensive. These prices were going up globally, not just for wheat, but across the board for cooking oil and for corn and for soy and all the inputs in farming and meat. All this stuff was going through the roof. In fact, globally, worldwide, food prices went up 80% in 2008. And, of course, for us, it was kind of a little pinch on the paycheck. Yes, there was hunger in America, a million hungry people in Los Angeles, one out of five kids at soup kitchens. We felt the pinch. But other countries where people are spending 80 or 90% of their paycheck on their daily bread, it throws them into poverty. Now, how did this happen? I just got a letter today in response to my article from the head of global risk from Goldman Sachs, insisting that this was a classic problem of supply and demand. Oh, there just wasn't enough wheat out there. That's why the price went up. That is just not true. That is patently false. There is always plenty of wheat. My article focused on a very particular kind of wheat called hard red spring. Hard red spring wheat is the wheat that makes the bread of the world, and it is also the wheat that is exported most around the world. The United States is the Saudi Arabia of cereal. What we do is we export wheat, and thus we control the price, the global price of wheat, to an inordinate effect. And what I really focused on in this article was the price of this particular kind of wheat, hard red spring wheat, out of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. It's a tiny little syndicate in Minneapolis that nobody really has ever heard of. They are controlling the price of hard red spring. And what I started to think is, well, look, if the price of food is going through the roof, and if the price of hard red spring is going through the roof, what is pushing this? And I should just say for a second that I do not have a background in wheat futures and commodity trading. I had to kind of apply myself to this for the past year and learn what a futures contract was. This is extremely, extraordinarily complicated stuff. The wall is very high. It's very hard to get over that wall. But once you're over that wall, you can see what these bankers, particularly Goldman leading the way, but everybody else, Deutsche, J.P. Morgan Chase, everybody is in on this. And there is a new kind. I mean, should we talk about the new kind of investment in wheat that transformed the price of wheat?
Yes, but before we get into that, I think it's really important for people to understand exactly what you've laid out about the impact that this all has in the world. In your article, you make a point of a billion people. You say that a quarter of a billion became hungry or, you know, on the edge of starvation. Yeah. But then there's a billion people who just couldn't even afford to buy bread any longer, directly That's related right. to what you're talking about. One of the things I wanted to say, too, is that I think if you could, because one of the reasons I read your article about three or four times is to try and get over that wall, you know, to understand. So if, when you come across terms like buying long and selling short and the futures, if you could just give a capsulized explanation, a very brief one, but the capsulized one that will help people get through.
I would love to. And it's something everybody, I think, really needs to know, because in order to stop this corruption that is going on, we need to enter into the complication. I mean, I think that so many Americans, they can understand complicated baseball and soccer, and they really get into sports, but however, they stop at a certain point when it gets the complication of financial. It is really not that complicated. When people say they're going to go short, that just means they're going to promise to sell. When people go long, that just means they're going to promise to buy. That's all it means. What's interesting about how wheat futures work and how commodities futures work is that it goes contrary to our whole sense of how economics works, in the sense that you generally buy something. If you're going to make money, let's say, in manufacturing, you're going to buy something, put it together, and then sell it, right? Mm-hmm. And then the idea is that you're going to sell it for more than you bought it for. However, when it comes to futures markets, it doesn't matter if you buy stuff first and sell it later, or sell it first and buy it later. that was kind of the biggest stumbling block I had. It doesn't matter what you do as long as you close out your position in the end. In other words, buy, sell, sell, buy. As long as there's a zero sum at the end, you're good in those markets. And the idea, of course, is that the price that you're selling for is higher than the price that you bought it for, no matter what the sequence, no matter what the sequence. And I have to say that the idea of there being contracts for future wheat, in other words, a promise to buy wheat at a certain date in the future or a promise to sell wheat in it at a certain date in the future, that is not such a bad thing. That's what I discovered. In fact, a lot of the reason why the price of wheat in this country in real terms has gone down for the past 100 years, stopping at 2003, that 100 years from 1903 to 2003, is because these markets with what are called bona fide hedgers, in other words, the farmers and the millers taking part in this market, with speculators who are buying and selling and buying every day, this actually helped to stabilize the price of wheat and help this country develop into what it is today. Now, what happened in 1991? Should we get into this complete transformation and subversion of this market that happened?
Just a second. Before you do, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Fred Kaufman, who's the author of The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. So, yeah, Fred, let's get into that. Along the lines of Stuck Pigs Squeal, you got a letter from Goldman Sachs. And to me, there's actually, yes, this thing of what actually opened the gates on this. When I mentioned that earlier going into the show about the point about the preliminary transformation into capital being necessary for anything to get done in this system, including the things that are basic human rights, shelter, food, things like that. This is exactly what you see in taking a major leap with this Goldman Sachs, the thing that they developed. Can you talk about that?
It's a complete and total outrage that they would make our daily bread into simply another way for them to make literally billions and billions of dollars. And here is what happened, is that in 1991, Goldman Sachs realized that stability in the wheat markets was not such a good thing. Because really, who likes, if you're a banker, who likes stable markets? What you want is volatility in the market. So they figured out a way for investors to drop hundreds of billions of dollars into wheat and other commodity futures. Huge pools of money. And we're going to get into in 1 second what Goldman and the other banks actually did with those huge pools of money, because the truth is they didn't put them all in to where they said they were going to put them in. They kept them to make their own money off of them. But what they did is they created this whole new subversion of the commodity business, and specifically when it comes to wheat. And what I mean is this. In the past, when you had speculators in the wheat market, for instance, as I was saying earlier, for every buy order, there would be a sell order. For every sell order, there would be a buy order. By the end of the day or by the end of the contract, everybody's position would close out. Mm-hmm. Goldman realized they did not have to do that. They could simply say, I'm going to buy a lot of wheat futures, and then do it. And then when that contract was up, simply roll those buy orders into the next futures contract. Let's be clear. They were not talking about buying real wheat. They never wanted or had any inclination to buy real wheat. They had no place to store it. They had nothing to do with it. What they were buying on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, for the most part, were promises to buy future wheat, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of promises. And each time, there are five times a year when these contracts come up, each time one of those contracts came up, they would do something called, they would do a rollover. And they would simply take those contracts, those promises, and roll them over into the next contract. And so what they accumulated was this historically unprecedented, vast pile of promises to buy wheat, never to be fulfilled, endlessly regenerated, this huge, huge pile of what are called long-only futures. And they did it through this vehicle called a commodity index fund. Okay? And so eventually what happened is they created what's called a demand shock. It is a very rare economic occurrence because guess what? They were doing the exact opposite of what common sense would have you do when you invest. When we invest, we like to buy something low, it goes up, and then we sell it. And if it goes down, right, we get out of it. But these guys, Goldman and the bankers, their commodity index funds, were price insensitive in the sense that no matter how high the price of wheat futures went, the investment tool demanded that they buy more They hold what they have and keep on buying more, keep on buying more. No matter how expensive it got, they kept on buying more. They kept on buying more. Now, what did they actually do with the money that was coming their way? Because you have to realize that people in 2008 were running scared. They were running scared because the economy was tanking, and they thought commodities would be a very safe haven because traditionally it is. And so, like I say, they had hundreds of billions of dollars pouring into these funds. What did the banks do with that money? They did not actually buy the wheat futures. It takes only about 5% of the total amount that you're investing to take that position. So what the banks did is they took 95%, all that other money, and they just put it into they put into T-bills, they put into very conservative investments, and then they leverage it so that $300 billion could become trillions, and then they'd invest it on their day accounts. They'd give it to their day trading. Now, what's the sum effect of all this long wheat contract? What happened was that because of this unceasing demand for wheat futures in this market, slowly and surely the price of a wheat future started going up. Starts going up slowly in 2003. In 2005, it starts going up a bit faster. In 2008, the price of wheat, which normally trades between $3 and $6 per 60-pound bushel on the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, closed on February 25, 2008, over $25 per bushel. This was unprecedented in the history of wheat, and this is what drove the world into hunger in 2008. This is what drove, for the first time in human history, the number of a billion hungry people on the planet.
I mean, I'm sitting here and my mind is just reeling because I'm thinking, okay, all these things that you talk about them buying long and they're buying wheat futures, they're actually buying wheat that they're never going to sell and it doesn't even exist at this point, you know, and everything is based on that, and that's having a terrible impact on what we actually have, which I think is important to go back to the point you made in the beginning of the starvation in the world is not a product of not enough food.
When I did this article, my editor is a brilliant editor named Luke Mitchell at Harper's, and we kind of cooked this thing up because what really irks us, and I think what should irk everybody, is the fact that people are now mistaking the virtual for the real. They're getting those two terms mixed up, particularly when it comes to financial products. So in other words, wheat is real. We need to eat it. Food is real, and you can't just start messing with that as though it's some sort of data point on a graph, right, which is precisely what they did. What Goldman Sachs and what Deutsche Bank and what PIMCO and what Reuters Jefferies and what across the board, what they did is they turned commodities into a mathematical formula. That's what they did. That's what the commodity index is a mathematical formula. And they said, okay, look, the formula looks like this. The rollover looks like this. This is a sure thing. Commodities have a natural rate of return. Give us your money. And eventually, they got tremendous pools of money from pension funds, from hedge funds, from California teachers, this sort of thing. I mean, you're sitting in a meeting in California. What are we going to do with our pile of cash? And some, you know, hotshot guy from New York comes in and says, we have a new investment vehicle. It's called a commodity index fund. It has this rate of return. Give us your money. What are you going to do? You know, you have to respect the expert in this case. And, of course, what they're doing is they're taking something real. They've transformed it into something virtual. They've mistaken the virtual for the real. And so when the investment is good, when the price goes up, isn't that fabulous? They've forgotten the essential fact, which is that there are real things in the world. It's not just all about the money.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Fred Kaufman. Fred's a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. He's also the author of The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that very much related to, in fact, the way that the real estate bubble developed and what happened after that is similar to what actually happened in the food market for a while, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and I think that what you're seeing is a pattern. I don't think we have to be geniuses to see a pattern in Wall Street, which is that they keep on trying to figure out how can we take something that is real, like a house or food, and turn it into a concept, turn it into a product that we can then monetize and control and figure out a way to fix the game, because what these guys are doing is taking all sorts of concepts like debt or risk, turning that into profit. They've done that for a hell of a long time. Well, now I think it's time that they're looking for other things. What else can we do this to? What else can we turn into a financial concept and get all the money out in our tried and true way?
Part of this thing is that you look at this, and to me, it really does talk about the, you know, not just the corruption of Goldman Sachs, actually A lot of that is actually definitely involved. You can see that. But there's also the point about the systemic nature of this, because Goldman Sachs actually inspired the formation of many, many other commodities index. And there's a systemic nature to this that actually does – the whole thing is just profit first and above everything else. And to me, one of the things that you brought out is you said if you could discover how this was actually operating, you might discover how – why a billion people in the world could no longer buy bread. And what you discovered was not so much just the individual corruption, but that there was a mechanism that actually was in place that led to this in a massive scale. And even though there was a temporary downspin in it, the possibility of this being even more dramatically, the prices increasing and this kind of thing continuing on. So maybe that with that one question, we could then wrap the show up.
Yeah, thank you. I think what a lot of these Wall Street bankers are failing to realize is that we actually all live in a state of mutuality with each other. And the more they just say, I want mine, screw you, that is going to be the way the world ends. That is going to be the big problem. Will it happen again? All the people I spoke to at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, all the hedge fund people I spoke to, they all say it's inevitable. They all say it is inevitable. Once this kind of systemic product is in place, it's inevitable. I hate to be such a terrible pessimist. The one possible answer I can see to this, and this is being floated by a number of groups, is an international grain reserve. In other words, when the prices start completely skyrocketing out of control, if there is an international, or even as America used to have under the Clinton administration, a farmer-owned grain reserve, if there's actual real grain that we can let into the market and say, guys, cool out, there actually is grain, because the ultimate irony is that the wheat harvest of 2008 was the greatest wheat harvest in all of human history.
And on that note, Fred, you know, and again, I would just add in one other thing. The thing about the solutions, I mean, to me, when you look at this, you're dealing with the increasingly parasitic nature of imperialism. I mean, that's the, you know, just to be blunt, to me, that's what it is. It's sort of, you're going to have this thing of they're constantly trying to squeeze out the highest rate of profit and doing, and they're pursuing that sort of, nothing's going to get in our way. So I think even the idea, like, we'll have to have you back, because I know you do a lot of writing on food. We'll have to have you back to talk about a lot of this, including investigating some of these things about famines and how these various corporations and the system actually operates in relation to famine. But thank you very much for this article, man.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Take care now.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Frederick Kaufman. He's a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, who's the author of The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It. You know, after today's show, I think there's just one quick quote that I'm going to take from Bob Avakian. Actually, it's a sentence that introduces a quote in his book, Basics. And that sentence is, "The world needs revolution. Anything else is bull." That about concentrates all we need to know for today. If you want to get the rest of that quote, again, it's available in the book Basics by Bob Avakian. I want to thank all of my guests today, Margaret Kimberly, Peter Gleick, and Frederick Kaufman. And I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with something I haven't played in quite some time, but I think this show really demands it. And that's We Can Change the World from Graham Nash.